This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 63. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on?
Hit tail is done, sir.
Good.
Yeah, I'm stoked. Just within the last hour, I wrapped up all the work that I, you know, talked about on the last podcast. So
cool.
It's done in terms of code complete, and I've tested it. You know, I'm pretty confident it's going to work. Of course, uploaded it to the server, and like all this stuff crashed because of, you know, configuration stuff. So I have some troubleshooting to do, but it's still early in the week, and I'm feeling good about hitting my deadline next week. So
mm-hmm.
It's been nice. You know, I've had to take a little crash course in jQuery. I really hadn't done much with it. Last time I did a lot of front-end stuff was maybe 4 years ago, and it was just coming into prominence. So that's been kind of cool to realize. It's super elegant. Have you worked a lot with it?
I've worked some with it, not a lot. What little I have worked with it, I mean, I know that it's pretty powerful and have seen some of the things that it can do and the way you attach functions to different pieces of the UI. I mean, that stuff is really kind of neat.
Yeah. So it's been a pleasant surprise. And it's also been pretty nice working with Stripe. You know, I'm a big PayPal proponent. I have several accounts. I basically pay them a pretty nice car payment in commissions each month just because of all the money I funnel through them. And I applied for the Website Payments Pro thing, which I already have one account for a different website. And that just allows you to process credit cards on the back end. Because right now, the way Hittail does it is it uses their basic subscriptions, which, as you know, are kind of mm-hmm. a nightmare. You can't update them. They cancel themselves all the time for random reasons. So you really don't have control of your customers. You can't run reports. There's all kinds of trouble. So I'm just going to do basic, you know, back-end HTTP post to process credit cards. So to do that, you get the Website Payments Pro. So I applied for it. It's basically a merchant account and, you know, in a gateway. And they rejected it. And I was like, what is the deal? And they told me that it's because I had to fill out what type of business Hittail was. It basically helps SEO, like online marketing, that kind of stuff. And they replied with like, internet marketing, they're too risky, internet marketing businesses are. I'm realizing that like, there's a certain meaning to the phrase internet marketing, right? It tends to be more of the, I'll say the more scammy stuff.
And it's more just a term than anything else, not really what you're doing. Yep.
Absolutely. It's not at all, right? I basically have a SaaS app that helps legitimate businesses. I mean, my customers are like legitimate businesses making money online, selling real products, often, you know, a lot of e-commerce sites. So it's just comical. And there's like 5 years. No, there's almost 6 years of history in this PayPal account because they were saying that there could be too many chargebacks because it's internet marketing. And I said, look at the last 6 years. There have been, you know, like five chargebacks or something in 6 years out of thousands of charges. And mm-hmm. But they were like, nope, we're not going to budge. So then I was just, grr, kind of like it comes back to roost. But anyways, all that, I went with Stripe.
Cool.
So yeah, it's been pretty cool. Yeah, they got a nice API. I think my one complaint is that they only have libraries, like server-side libraries for PHP, Ruby, and Python.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And it's just like, wait a minute. Now, there are third-party libraries and stuff, but they're not complete.
Right.
That seems like an oversight to me. I mean, I'm in classic ASP, not expecting a VB script implementation, but I was kind of at one point considering doing it in .NET, and I had to go to like some third-party rando thing that, you know, is missing some calls and such.
Yeah, I see. I'm looking at it now. I do see that they have, you know, like a Stripe.net library that somebody has contributed. And there's a bunch of others that people have contributed, which it's nice that those things are available. But at the same time, it sucks that you have to rely on a third party library instead of one, you know, that they offer. Because if they ever make updates to their API or make some changes, it could be, you know, weeks or never before those APIs get updated. So, you know, if they break something, you're going to have to go in and fix it. And that's something that all the open source proponents have said, oh, it's open source, you can fix the code anytime you want. It's like, well, I don't want to have to. Just give me the library. I mean, you guys are the ones who are offering this as a service. That's why that's why you sign on with those services.
Right. I think the one saving grace is that they do version their API. So it's, you know, it's like stripe.com/v1/blah. So even if they update it, I'm sure they'll put it in a v1.1 or a v2.0. So, and hopefully, you know, not break the back kind of backwards compatibility.
Right, right.
Ideally, but I do hear you. I would much prefer to have a supported full API, because even with the .NET one, there was some stuff I was going to do that where the calls just weren't implemented in the class library.
Mm.
So, anyways, yeah, I had some hesitations about going with Stripe. They're a startup. I mean, it's basically like if they go down, that's catastrophic for me, right? Mm-hmm. If they go out of business, if they start charging an exorbitant amount, I mean, I know PayPal can be a pain in the ass, but they are pretty stable. And yeah. If Stripe has to do some big thing, because their pricing is very odd. There's no monthly fee at all. Yeah. And it's like 2.9% on every transaction. I cannot see that as a sustainable pricing model at all. Because PayPal is by far the cheapest right now. And they're 2.9% plus $30 a month. And Authorize.net tends to be around 2.1 to 2.5% per transaction, but they're up between $50 and $100 a month, depending on who you get. I just don't think it's viable. Having worked in the credit card industry, knowing the amount of fraud and expense that goes into purely into risk management mm-hmm. and reducing fraud, I mean, that's why you pay so much for these credit card accounts, you know, these merchant accounts and such. I mean, and because Authorize.net, you know, wants to make an exorbitant amount of money. I can see being a little bit cheaper maybe than PayPal, maybe, but I just not doing a monthly fee, I don't see as sustainable. Now, maybe they'll grandfather existing customers in, that'd be fine. And maybe down the line, they'll start charging $10 or $20 a month. And again, I'd be fine with that. But it's my only concern is if suddenly they just have to, you know, they're going under, they're out of their VC money, because I'm sure that's what they're on at this point. I haven't researched them, but I imagine that's what they're going. And they're running out, and then they just have to do, what was it, Chargeify, that was like, a bunch of people connected to their API, and then they had to like double or triple their pricing.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was just pissed, because it's like, you've already invested all this time. You don't want to leave. And they didn't grandfather people in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, looking forward to getting this new design live, and I'll point people to that after it's all done in the next week or so.
Cool.
And how about you? What's new?
I decided that I was going to run a bit of an informal survey on my blog, and I ran it inside the academy and asked a couple of people if they could comment on it. But basically, the survey was around WordPress and whether people had any thoughts about the security of it, whether there were concerns about it. And so far, I'm not necessarily surprised by the results of the survey. I mean, it's still going on. It's still listed on my blog, and I throw it out on Twitter a couple times. But roughly, let's see here, about 25 people have come in and weighed in on it so far. And of those, about 30% have said that they feel that security of their WordPress sites is a problem that needs to be addressed. And the other 70% have said no, they don't think that it's an issue.
All 25 have used WordPress or use WordPress currently?
Yes, every okay. single one. Because that was one of my first questions was, how many sites do you have running WordPress? And
got
there's
it.
Not one person who said none. 6 said 1, 9 said 2 to 5, 3 said
got
6
it.
To 10, 1 person or 2 people said 11 to 20, and 3 people said more than 20.
So either people self-selected and didn't answer if they weren't. If they
yeah.
have a WordPress site, or just a lot of people use WordPress, probably a little of both.
Right. And I said, hey, if you use WordPress, then please fill this out. You know, I didn't
got
ask
it.
People
okay.
who weren't using it. I tried to self-select a
You've
little
self-selected
bit.
It. Okay. So what do you think? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Or why did you do that?
Well, I did it more because I've been thinking more about what directions I want to go with Audit Shark and how I want to push it into the small banking industry. And it really seems to me like, you know, I have to pick something that people are going to be more familiar with. I don't know as configuration. I think configuration management may be just a little bit more advanced than most people are ready for. And I don't want to go through the process of educating them about why they should be doing it. I don't want to have to do that. So I think that if I were to take kind of a step down a little bit in terms of the complexity of what I'm doing, then vulnerability management or patch management kind of is the next step down that, you know, I can still use all the code that I have. Basically, I just need to build different rules for the engine to run. And I haven't really built very many rules to begin with, so it's not really like I'm creating any more work for myself. I just have to decide which of those directions I want to go. And the primary advantage of something like that is that I can sell it online. I don't necessarily have to walk into somebody's environment to be able to sell it, because people are generally familiar with what virus scanners and patch scanners do. So I think that poses some definite advantages. But one of the other things I was looking at was, are there other places where I could build kind of a very specific version of the Audit Shark engine and use it for something like that? So auditing WordPress installations seem like it might be viable. So I wanted to do the research a little bit before I actually went and built something.
Got it. Yeah, there are now. There's already at least one service. I'm sure there are more, but there's a service I have no idea what it's called, but I used it when I got hacked with the Tim Thumb vulnerability the last couple months. And it had some weird name. I'm sure if you put WordPress security scan, you'll find it in Google. Yeah, you could do as many free scans as you wanted online. And then it was like, if you wanted it to automatically scan, they charged, you know, $99 a year. And I think then it did a daily scan or something, or hourly, who knows. And it would let you know of stuff. And I think it might even help, or at least suggest how to clean it up. So you might want to take a look at that, because that's what you're suggesting, right? Of perhaps going in that direction.
Yeah, I didn't really fully flesh out what my idea around what I was going to do was. I mean, because one of the questions that I asked was, you know, what would you want to see in a product for monitoring your website? And the responses were kind of all over the place. I mean, some people said, I'm all set. Other people said, I want something that will notify me the second a new vulnerability comes out that I'm susceptible to. And other people said that they wanted it to be able to take backups and snapshots and make sure that their WordPress installation was able to be reverted if things changed at all. It was really all over the map.
Right. Yeah, that seems like a just kind of a whole different market than, I know the code can be similar or you can have overlap, but like completely different.
The code's identical.
Structure.
That's the funny part.
Just to do a scan and look at vulnerability, not to do all the stuff people are asking for. Because
right.
I think once you get into it, like the real money, the loss leader will be the scans. Because a lot of people, I would guess, have done that. But it'll be like, to make the real money, you'll have to add all these advanced features people are asking. And then there will be additional code. And in addition, you'll have to figure out if you want to sell to direct to, you know, consumers like myself, or if you want to go to like web hosts and try to sell them, you know, large licenses for, I don't know, I think of DreamHost or WP Engine or someone who manages thousands of WP installs if they have something like this or would license it from you. So
right.
Yeah, it just seems really different than going after the banking market.
Right.
But if it's a pivot, you know, if you figure out that's a way to go.
Yeah. And like I said, it was just an idea that I was kicking around. So I said, hey, why not do a little bit of the market research and see what people think of it.
Right. I realized I never mentioned it on the podcast, but I returned my Kindle Fire within the 30 days.
Mm.
Yeah, remember I brought it up. I really liked it, and I couldn't justify keeping it and having an iPad. What's the problem? I mean, I felt so lame. So I returned
it. Did you postpone because you were lame?
yeah, I did. I said I just have too much money to spend on gadgets. No, I decided to return it. But I'm still like recommending it to people. You know, if my mom was going to get a tablet, I would kind of ask her what she's using it for. It's like I said, the Kindle Fire, not as good as the iPad for web browsing, but pretty much everything else I tried to do with it in terms of content consumption was awesome. So I just kind of wanted to update folks and close that loop that I still have faith in it. And I mean, honestly, for $200 for less than half the price of the low-end iPad, if I ever got my kids a tablet or something, it would be something like that. And the form factor was pretty nice too. It was a little thick, a little heavier than I'd want it to be, but for a kid, it was very small and it was just perfect size for him. He was playing Angry Birds. You know, it's Android Engine, so it has all the games that you'd want on it.
I see. Yeah, the only other thing I have is I finally got around to updating my SSL certificate for Audit Shark, which was a lot more of a nightmare than it should have been. I went through, was it Komodo the first time, and then I didn't realize it, but they basically gave me a 90-day SSL certificate, which I sort of vaguely recall there being this 90-day limit on it, but I thought I could renew it and that I'd have to renew it every 90 days. Turns out that's not the case, and they ask you to renew it, and then they want to charge you, I forget what the price was, but I think it was a little bit higher than their regular prices. So I looked at that, and I said, well, you know, what else is out there? And I took a look, and I went with Rapid SSL instead, and they actually offered a pretty good price. I think it was $55 or something like that for 2 years. But the process of getting it was an absolute nightmare because you don't have an account when you go through them, because Rapid SSL is owned by GeoTrust, and GeoTrust, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is owned by VeriSign. So you've got these three different SSL companies, but they all do exactly the same thing. It's just everyone knows who VeriSign is, and you may or may not have heard of GeoTrust or Rapid SSL. Because they don't have an account management system, you can't really log into your account and get your SSL certificates. You don't have an account to log into, so they rely on email. And for whatever reason, I was not getting emails. I mean, I applied for the certificates like early this morning. I literally just got them, not the certificates, but like I just got some emails with like some confirmations of stuff I was trying to get from their website. And it's probably 10, 12 hours later that I finally got these emails that I would have expected to have a long time ago.
Right.
So it's just a little irritating, but whatever. It's over and done with now, so.
Yeah. I guess it's a little bit of a get what you pay for type thing.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think my biggest disappointment is that SSL certificates just seem like a great scam, and I'm just very disappointed that I didn't get in on it years ago.
Sure.
I think we have, three questions from listeners to kind of talk about today?
That's right. I think this will probably wrap up our listener questions series. We had a bunch of backlogged, and now we're getting them done. So today we're going to be talking about, let's see, there's some things about launching around Christmas, generic product names, offline marketing techniques, that kind of stuff. So let's get with our first one. It's a voicemail.
Hi, I have two questions. First one is on 58, Rob mentioned that he was hurrying because he didn't want to wait too long to market his product. My question is if it's a good idea to like launch a product just before Christmas. My second question is, I'm an app developer for Android. My question is if I should go for a generic name, for example, electrician calculator for my app, or if I should look for a name that will differentiate my product. If this like makes a big difference, my URL is rfxlabs.com, where you can see more about the electrician calculator and give me any feedback. Thanks.
All right. So good questions. I'm going to take a crack at both of them. The first is about launching around Christmas time. And I had talked about launching Hittail. I mean, I was trying to get the redesign done in, you know, November, basically, October, November. And once it hit the first week of December, I knew it was too late because basically the business world goes dead the last 2 to 3 weeks of December. And I mean, .NET Invoice takes a huge hit every December. Anything that does not recurring revenue basically plummets, at least in my experience, in my, you know, 8 to 10 businesses. The SaaS revenue, recurring revenue obviously continues, but it doesn't grow. And I was actually just talking about, with another SaaS founder, and he was trying to run like some split testing during this time. And we were both remarking on it, just how little traffic he actually had just for the past, you know, 7 to 10 days. And frankly, people, I mean, everyone's just kind of in the mindset of buying presents and taking time off. So I don't think anyone really wants to make any big purchases during that time. So yeah, once I hit the first week of December, I knew that it was going to be the second week of January. I was going to wait about 4 to 5 weeks to do it. And I would give that advice to anyone. There's been a couple folks who've emailed me and said, hey, I'm just getting ready to launch, you know, and it was like December 10th. And I basically said, man, unless there's a real compelling reason to do it, don't do it now.
Totally agree. I mean, I think that any time in December is just a bad idea. I would have to argue that even in late November is probably also a bad idea, unless you've already got a mailing list that you've been kind of hammering on a little bit. I don't think that launching in the last 2 weeks of November is a good idea either.
Right, because there's Thanksgiving in the States and there's just people are gearing up for the holidays. I think the one exception is what you mentioned. We run a special in the Academy. We tend to do it in December. And that's because we already have relationships with people and we do it fairly early. I mean, you can do that. But in terms of launching a brand new product and trying to get press and trying to promote it, I think that's a tough sell.
I can think of actually one notable exception to that is that somebody inside the Academy, I saw what they were doing. They were building a website called elfontheshelfideas.com.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all about different ways that, you know, if you're not familiar with it, there's this thing called Elf on the Shelf, a little, I guess, doll that you can get for your kids and try to convince them essentially that Santa Claus watches them through that elf and that elf reports back to him every night and it moves around the house, but people have problems trying to figure out what to do with their elf after the first couple of days because there's only so many places that you can put it. And if you go to elfontheshelfideas.com, they show images of what other people have done with the elf on the shelf. So like there's actually a video there of somebody who had taped it to a overhead fan and turned it on.
Nice.
There's various other things, but that's probably the one exception that I can think of. So if it's holiday specific, then sure, go for it. But otherwise, I would say it's probably a bad idea anytime in November or December.
Right. Okay. The second part of his question was about he has a product that's basically an Android app, and it's a calculator for electricians and dealing with voltages and all kinds of resistance and whatever, something they would use in the field. Which I think is actually a really cool idea. I used to be an electrician and I looked through the feature set and there was a lot of handy things there that, you know, I used to do by hand in the field. Question was whether he should try to name it fancy name or use a generic product name like electrician calculator. The answer, of course, is it depends, right? It depends on what you're building. If you have a new social network, you probably want some fancy-dancy name. If you have a product like this where people are likely to search for it, they are likely to search for it by that generic name, and a tool in that ecosystem, meaning the Android ecosystem, does not already exist with that name, I would go with the generic name. Because if me as an electrician was going to go search for it, what would I type into the Android search box? I would type in electrician calculator, electrical calculator, something like that. And so if you have that name, you will tend to rank number one for that term. And so even though there may not be a huge amount of traffic, any traffic that does come for it is going to come to you. In addition, if you can at all get the .com, the exact match .com, .net, or .org domain name, so electrician calculator or electrical calculator, .com, .net, or .org, figure out which of those has more searches in Google, get that domain name and build a product website. Again, it won't get waves of traffic, but you will get the, you know, the trickle of traffic that the people typing that into Google. You'll just rank really high with an exact match domain name. You'll rank really high pretty easily. I think the flip side is picking out like a fancy name of, I don't even know what you'd call it, but the, you know, the Shazam machine calculator or whatever, especially in that niche, I don't really see a lot of value to it. I just don't think you need to be super fancy. I don't see much of a reason to do it.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I mean, I think that going with some sort of fancy name that doesn't necessarily indicate what the product does because it's designed for Android. I mean, it's not like somebody's going to sit there on their computer and be looking on the web for that sort of thing. I mean, if it's made for Android, they're going to be searching for it there. And to get the maximum screen time, and I don't know how the Android search mechanism for apps works, but I would assume that it's going to be keyword based, and having it in the product name is going to help you a lot more probably than if you have it mentioned a couple of times inside of the description.
Exactly. So obviously, if there were already 5 or 10 electrician calculators out there and you really wanted to differentiate yourself, then maybe you would think about that.
Or you would name it something very similar and then say Pro or something along those lines to indicate that it is better than the other ones that they may see alongside of it. Because, of course, you know, why would you want the light edition if you can get the Pro version?
Right. And to potentially invite lawsuits too.
Yeah.
Our next question is from Adam, and he is at bookingtimes.com. And he says, Rob, you mentioned that Mike should go out and meet customers face-to-face. I'm also about to launch my new web app, but I'm also convinced that there's a huge untapped offline market that will involve other marketing techniques. I think Booking Times is like a practice management. It's online clinic practice management. So I'm not sure if that's like medical clinic or psychiatric, but something like that. My only thoughts for other marketing techniques are cold calling and face-to-face meetings. I think direct mail would also fall into those, doing trade shows, that kind of stuff. That was my little insert there. What would you guys recommend for a technical person to do this when they don't have a customer sign-up list? Well, first of all, why don't you have a customer sign-up list? Because even if it's only 10 or 20 people, it's great to have those beta testers. But if you don't, my thoughts are, number one, Google them. So this is still Adam. My thoughts are, number one, Google them. See if they're currently online or offline. If they're online, see if they're a good fit customer. If not, look for reviews and see if I can help them. Number two, ring them and ask if they would be into discussing how they can best utilize the internet into their business. And number three, go and see them face to face. I could create a fake account in my app and copy their logo, etc., into my site and show them what we could do for them personally. Only takes 5 to 10 minutes. I'd be interested in hearing what you guys have done in the past. Okay, so a little more info about Booking Times. It appears that Mike was just bringing up an example that he might be targeting, like, say, dental clinics, and some of them may not be online at all. Some of them may not have internet access. They may not be able to use a SaaS app. You know, Adam is saying that he would contact them and find out if they're a good fit for his service and potentially bring up maybe some reviews that people have commented on their dental practice, and even trying to educate them and get them online. So with that set, he has some different thoughts on how to do this. Mike, why don't you go first and kind of riff on this, and then I'll add some color.
Sure. So some of my first thoughts were, as soon as he mentioned Googling them to find out whether they're online or offline, I assume that he's probably going to target companies that are local to him. And that makes sense, because those are the types of people that he would be able to easily go visit. You know, if you can target people who are within a 20 or 30 or 50 mile radius of where you live, it's much easier to go see them than if they're across the country. When you're doing something like that, I would probably recommend finding a VA, because that can be a very time intensive activity. I mean, it will take you a long, it can take you a long time to identify those people, and it would probably be a lot easier for you to simply hand that off to a VA and say, hey, find me as many of these people as you possibly can, as opposed to trying to do it yourself. It's not that you can't do it yourself, it's just that there may be a lot of them, and doing some of that initial pre-qualification may just take a lot more time than you think it would.
And I think that's a really good idea. I actually have a VA doing that right now for ATEL. It's been great use of time.
Yep. So that was my first thought on that. And then the depending on who you get as your VA could actually make some of those calls for you and essentially act as not necessarily a sales rep, but essentially somebody who's going to pre-qualify those people. So you're not wasting your time talking to people who they already have something or they just don't care about it. It's not a big enough problem for them. If the VA can talk to them and say, hey, would you be interested in talking to somebody further about this, then you can go ahead and have the VA try and set up appointments. But I think that those are my initial thoughts. The next one that I have is more of a big thing, and it's which something that I'm kind of dealing with Audit Shark, is the fact that going to meet with customers eats into your time that you're doing for other things. And even though it may not be too much extra time, like maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes extra out of your day, the problem is they're going to want to meet with you during business hours. And if you have other things going on during your business hours or during their business hours, such as a full-time job or consulting clients, it's going to be very difficult for you to get away in order to go meet with prospective customers for a product that you're trying to get off the ground. That's one of those reasons why I'm looking to do something a little bit different with Audit Shark, where I'm trying to move it more online.
Got it. Yeah, I think the bottom line is this is, you know, this is true outbound marketing, and this is going to be super time intensive. Like, this is traditional outbound sales, trying to get a funnel, cold calling, mailing, and face-to-face meetings. And to have a product like this succeed, you are going to have to charge a lot of money for it. I think that charging anything less than $99 a month, I'm assuming it's a SaaS app, charging anything less than $99 a month, there's no chance it'll work. And my guess is, as you try to scale up, if you try to hire people and not do everything yourself, you will probably have to raise prices to $199 a month as a minimum. These are just rules of thumb, but I look at any company who does this kind of outbound sales and they are quite expensive. Often they're $200 to $500 per month at their lowest plan. You look at like HubSpot, they're $199 a month for nonprofits, and they have a huge, they have 200 employees, 200 something employees. More than half of those, I think it's like 60-70% are salespeople, right? They have just a very sales-heavy organization. And that's the way it's structured. They're an outbound sales organization, and you can be very successful at that, but you really got to invest a lot of time. You either have to know what you're doing or invest a lot of time or, frankly, do both. I can recommend a book that is awesome for this. It's called The Ultimate Sales Machine. If you haven't read it and you're going to be doing outbound sales like this, I highly recommend it. The other thing I'd mention is I really would look for some way to start getting some inbound traffic for this. I cannot imagine that this market is that competitive when it comes to SEO and, you know, social media, potentially even some advertising avenues. I know that's not going to be, you're not going to be able to build 100% of a business via those routes, and you're going to get a lot more business by doing the outbound stuff. But my guess is your cost per customer acquisition for the customers you can get through those inbound marketing approaches will be substantially less than, you know, all the face-to-face and cold calling techniques. And for our final question of the day, we have an email from Joe Moore. And he says, hey, Mike and Rob, it's a question about outsourcing versus keeping someone in-house. First, I just want to say how much I enjoy the podcast. I especially appreciate the show's consistent format that you've established, which perfectly sets up the occasional deviations, like when Mike forgets the opening line or something. I love that. Nice. He does that pretty often.
I do not.
We leave in 1 out of 10 of the screw-ups. So my business partner and I are currently bootstrapping a web startup. And I'm the design guy, not because I'm that good at design, but rather due to our original design guy bailing on us. My plan is to pay someone to take my place designing the website themes in the future as soon as we can afford it. Here's my question. With both quality and value in mind, but mostly quality, do you think it would be better to outsource that work on a case-by-case basis, like through Elance, or to bring a designer on staff with a monthly salary? In what circumstances would each option be more appropriate? Thanks so much, Joe in Albany, New York.
So here's my thoughts on it. Unless you have a fairly large organization where you are consistently churning out new stuff that needs to be designed on a very, very regular basis, do not hire somebody to do design. And the reason for that, I think, is very simple. I mean, what you really want is you want the best design you can possibly get. And going to outsource that is probably your best bet. And the reason for that is because you can go to a number of different places where you can get multiple people who are going to try and submit designs for whatever it is that you're looking for. 99 Designs, for example. Essentially, what you want to do is you want to go to find people who are going to be able to do exactly what it is that you want. Now, there's going to be cases where you want something that's got more of a cartoony feel, or you need something done in Flash, or you need something that's done in HTML. There's very few designers that have skills that are going to go across the board. Most of them are going to be able to give you overall design stuff. Most are going to have some sort of a niche that they fall into. For example, the same applies to programmers. I mean, you go hire a programmer. If you want somebody to do Perl programming, that's great. You know, you find somebody who does Perl. But what happens in 3 to 5 weeks when you need somebody who knows Cold Fusion, or you need them to know PowerShell or something along those lines? Don't get me wrong, a developer can learn them, but it may be a lot more cost effective for you to hire somebody who has those skill sets, because the time window for them to utilize those is going to be so small. You may want to hire a designer, but how long is it going to take them to become proficient with Flash? At that point, you may as well just outsource. And you're going to probably find with designers that you're going to end up outsourcing a lot, even though you have a designer on staff, because they just don't know how to use those other tools.
I'd agree. I mean, it sounds like he said there are going to be website themes in the future that they're going to need. So they are going to need ongoing design work. But I completely agree. Hiring someone on salary is just, it's such a burden that you take on. You really got to have, you have to have a lot of design work to ongoing to keep someone busy, you know, for 40 hours a week. And I've seen fantastic designs. I've received fantastic designs from outsourced designers. So I think building a relationship with a single outsourced designer is definitely where I would start with this. And then you can always move to employment later. I mean, if the man or woman really works out, you can always hire them later if they want to be brought on. Or if they don't want to be, you can keep using them, or, you know, find someone else. So
I think that's the other thing, is that just exactly as you said, I mean, if you find somebody else and you decide that, hey, we really have a need to bring somebody on full time, you can offer them a job, assuming that you like them enough. But it gives you an opportunity to essentially test drive that person and figure out how well they would work out as an employee. If you hire somebody out of the gate, I think that you feel a lot more invested in that, because you have hired them full time. You probably went through this process where you interviewed people and brought them in, and you spent a lot of time and effort talking to all these people, and you don't want to throw that away. I mean, I've gone through the same thing myself. I mean, you don't want to get rid of somebody because they don't have the skills you need, or the work isn't coming in quite as well as you'd like. So you tend to hold on to them a lot more than you would if you had them just as a contractor. I mean, if it's a contractor, you just don't give them work if you don't have it.
Yeah, and if you're going to go out and look for designers, like Mike said, 99 Designs is a really good place to go. There's this other cool site that I found. It's called dribble.com, and it's D-R-I-B-B-B-L-E. It's got three Bs. And it's basically designers who are kind of dribbling out their current designs that they're working on. So a lot of them are actually, you know, working on client designs, and they're putting them out. And so I've found a couple good designers on there, including, you know, one of the most recent ones that I used to help me with some part of the app parts of Hittail.
That's cool. I'd never heard of them.
Yeah, it's like a designer social network, you know, and I feel like as you look at it, you get the inside look at what designers are doing and how they kind of relate to each other and stuff. And so, and it's cool because it's all visual. I mean, it's a little bit like Pinterest, frankly, just all visual. And as you flip through, you can just click on somebody's stuff. And then, of course, they typically link to their portfolio. You can contact them or get an idea of what kind of work they do.
I see. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I'd recommend that.
Well, I think that pretty well wraps us up for the day. Rob?
I'm on the wrong page.
Leave it in.
No, don't leave it in. If you have a question or comment, please call it into our voicemail number, 888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, we'd love a review in iTunes. You can search for Startups, and you can subscribe to us in iTunes as well. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.